and she held her breath until, after a moment, he retreated once again. Johnny was forgotten, all thoughts back on her current husband. So, he wasn't going to sleep with her again tonight. Was this how their marriage was going to be from now on? A quiet punishment? Separate rooms and smiles for the sake of appearances until he met someone else or had climbed so high up the social ladder they could finally slip into a polite second divorce? Or was he waiting for all this to settle down and then he'd screw her over to be with Jackie again? She lay there for a long 30 minutes and then pushed the covers away. What had he been doing all night? More late night phone calls? Probably. He'd have his phone with him, so she couldn't check that. But what else? She crept through to his study and turned his computer on, relieved to discover the password hadn't changed. She went to his sent emails, and this time she read them all, not just looking for something that might hint at an affair. He'd certainly been busy. A raft of messages sent to clients explaining that William was gravely ill, and that given that they were a boutique firm, there might be a knock-on effect at the partnership for the next week or so, and asking for client patience, but he would be doing his best to make sure everything was running as smoothly as possible, and to email him directly with any queries about their accounts. Next, there were two to the auditors, putting the audit on hold indefinitely, and in no uncertain terms. Then there was one to Emmett, sent first at just after midnight, telling him to pick up his phone. She sat back in the leather chair and stared at it until the words blurred. Why would he want to speak to Emmett in the middle of the night? Jason and Emmett weren't even that close, were they? She closed down his email and stared at the homepage, her mind whirring. All those late night calls. Could they have been Emmett? But why at night, when she was asleep? Because Virginia was asleep too? What had they been discussing? Money. Investments. That's what Emmett did. Had Jason invested money with Emmett? She looked at the screen again and then she noticed. The untitled folder, the one containing the spreadsheet of numbers, had vanished. The only one on his screen to have been deleted. Jason had been tidying up. The computers at the office all crashing. The argument with William. What had he said?
The audit starts Monday, Jason, and if this isn't made good by then.
How had Jason explained it?
A transfer gone wrong.
She couldn't breathe. The rush of information to her brain like pure oxygen, leaving her dizzy. That trouble with his father years ago that left his name tarnished and Jason having to claw his way back. Had Jason become like his father? Had he been embezzling from the company? Money. Not a woman. His foul moods, the late night calls, all down to money trouble, not a woman. Not Keisha, not Jackie, not some cheap scheming waitress looking for a rich husband. But Jason covering his tracks. The fights over her expensive furniture and remodeling choices. This house. How had he paid for it? Other people's money? And here he was, judging her for her secrets, when he was on the cusp of ruining them both. The fucking bastard. She woke him with breakfast in bed. Scrambled eggs, bacon, and home fries, and a pot of fresh, strong coffee. There was even a flower in a small vase on the tray, like he used to bring her when they first got together. She put the tray beside the guest room bed, as he blinked, confused at the noise waking him.
What are you doing, Marcy?
He glanced at the tray as if it were as dangerous to his health as William's coconut water had been to his.
I'm not hungry.
She pulled the drapes wide, letting bright sunlight stream in.
Jesus!
She turned to face him.
We need to talk.
He groaned, one arm blindfolding him.
I need another hour's sleep, and then I should go see how William is doing, show my face at the hospital.
She poured two cups of coffee and sat on the side of the bed. Since shutting down his computer, she'd veered between laughing and crying, and now she just needed to know the extent of the shit they were in. It was his turn to squirm a little. "Don't you worry?" she asked thoughtfully, before pausing and sipping her coffee. Their best china for a morning like this.
"Worry about what?" he snapped.
"That whoever found out about my past also knows about you." For the briefest second, his whole body froze, and then he rubbed his face as if impatient with her.
"Know what about me, Marcy? I'm too tired for this."
"The money, Jason." A long pause. "All the company money." There it was. That strange expression as if someone she didn't know had slipped inside Jason's skin. "How did it start?" she continued. "The occasional borrow from a client account, then heavier dipping and having to move funds around, borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. Did it all get out of hand? Did you invest some client funds with Emmett, hoping to make enough to replace what you'd taken and still buy William out of the firm?" She felt sick as she voiced her suspicions. When had things gotten so bad?
"You're crazy," he said coldly. "You've been crazy for a while now."
"Me? Really? You've been moody as hell for the best part of a year, and don't tell me it's all in my head. That bullshit won't wash with me. Just tell me if I'm right. I need to know the truth, Jason." He pushed the sheets off and got out on the other side of the bed.
"I need to shower, and so do you. We have to go to the hospital."
"You're really going to ignore me?" She found she wasn't surprised. Handsome and charming he might be, but Jason had never been good with confrontation. He closed down, refused to discuss. He'd done the same with Jackie when he'd divorced her. At the time, Marcy had been young and stupid and thought he was being strong, but she'd been entirely wrong. He'd simply been too weak to face the woman he was leaving. "No wonder you're so happy the police have taken Keisha. All that evidence they have against her stops them looking at both of us, doesn't it? Not just me, but you too, you sanctimonious prick." The cussing tasted good in her mouth. He'd earned it. "Keisha wasn't the only one with something to gain by William's death. This is all working out quite well for you too, isn't it?" Jason paused in the doorway, spots of color blotched on his suddenly pale face.
"What are you implying?"
He looked aghast.
"Are you asking if I poisoned William? Of course I didn't. And for what it's worth, I don't think you did either, so forgive me for being slightly relieved for both our sakes that it looks pretty obvious that Keisha did."
Marcy stared at him. "So you did steal the money?"
"I didn't steal it, I borrowed it."
There was a long pause, and then his spine crumpled, his shoulders rolling forward as he sighed.
"It got out of hand. I was in the process of putting it all back, I promise you. But there's been a delay, and I could only cover so much. I wasn't expecting William to organize the audit, not so quickly."
"But why?" she asked. "Why do it in the first place?" Having her suspicions confirmed had knocked the anger out of her, and now she was confused and afraid. Was there anything real in their marriage at all? If this was to come out, they'd be ruined, imprisoned. Who'd believe that she hadn't known?
"I could see the way you looked at them," he said, shrugging helplessly. "William and Eleanor, Iris and Noah, even Virginia and Emmett. I wasn't stupid. I knew we were the poor relations of our friendship group."
"You've never been poor, Jason. Far from it."
"Everything is relative. Happiness, health, wealth. You envied them."
"So did you. We had that in common."
"I did. But mainly I wanted to make you happy. First your store didn't work out, and then you were so insistent about having this house."
"You stop right there, Jason Maddox." Marcy couldn't believe what she was hearing. What kind of bullshit was this? "Are you really trying to put this on me? I didn't make you steal anything. You did that all by yourself." She wouldn't have been so stupid to have risked their whole lives just for a bigger house. Why the hell had he? "We could have stayed in our old house," she said, quieter this time. "I wouldn't have minded if you'd explained that money was tight." Was that true? If she was honest, she preferred their old house. It was warmer. But this house, this was impressive. It commanded respect, and that counted for something, didn't it?
No, it's not your fault, of course not. I'm just trying to explain.
Jason was so pathetic, his voice almost whining.
When we met, you looked at me as if I could conquer the world, and that made me believe I could. You never put me down like Jackie had. I wanted to keep that feeling, but it changed. The more you saw of this life, the more you wanted it, and I couldn't, can't blame you for that.
He looked up at her, his eyes full of despair.
I'm so, so sorry. I wanted you to be happy. In a week or so, all the money will be back where it should be, I promise you. I'll never do anything like it again. It's been killing me, it really has. So much deception. I couldn't look at you or William, I felt so bad.
He took her hand.
But I didn't hurt William. I swear to God I didn't. I love you, Marcy, I really do.
Marcy was at a loss for words, instead wanting to pummel all her feelings out against his face. Did he really think she was going to believe that pile of horseshit? That he'd done it for her? She looked at him again, his face so earnest, and realized that yes, he did think she'd go for it. Maybe he was even convinced of it. It was easier than taking the blame himself. She gritted her teeth. Did she want to have this fight right now, or was it safer all around to just let it ride? I love you too, she murmured in the end, squeezing his hand back. But what a mess. Despite her conciliatory words, her heart thumped with no small amount of anger. So she wasn't the only one with a secret to protect in this marriage. Her beloved Jason wasn't so pure himself. Beloved. Did she love him anymore? She wondered, as he leaned in and kissed her, his mouth hot and stale from lack of sleep, his tongue probing for comfort and forgiveness from hers. She let him move her back on the bed. Of course they were going to have sex, an affirmation of their union, a reminder that they were in this together, for better or for worse. What she normally took for passion felt needy as he gripped her neck and hair and pulled her close, panting and pushing himself into her. She let her body move in rhythm with his, and even as her nerves tingled, responding, she felt somewhat detached. He'd been horrible to her for months, and then made her feel like it was her fault. He'd gaslighted her, and now she was supposed to forgive him just like that. At least her secrets hadn't affected him, not until now. They'd stayed hers, private, irrelevant. She ran her hands over the familiar firmness of his chest, around to his back, lingering in the curve of his spine, before teasing the line down to his ass, trailing a finger along the crevice of his butt, knowing how the hint of the illicit excited him. She wanted him to come, and quickly. She wasn't ready to have sex with him. She wasn't sure she even wanted to ever again. She was angry with him. She pitied him. It was all so different from how sex was with Keisha, how everything was with Keisha. But Keisha was in jail, and Jason was here, and they all had bigger problems to deal with than who she preferred fucking. Thankfully, he came fast. 45. Keisha hadn't slept all night. Not because of the unfamiliar bleak surroundings and the unforgiving excuse for a bed. In fact, the bare cell had been almost comforting. It was almost a relief to find herself back in the gutter where she belonged. But because she could no longer trust her own memory. Her mind had never been her friend, but now that her head was clearer thanks to some proper medication, the thick, dark storm clouds had evaporated and left her facing a sea of doubts. What was real and what wasn't? The past few days were a haze, a terrible dream made up of disjointed moments. Yesterday, the police had spent so much time talking to her about what they'd thought she'd done, they'd half convinced her that she had poisoned William. She wanted him dead, yes. She had wished him dead. She could see the bottle of coolant in her mind's eye, the syringe, the coconut water, her hands at work. But that wasn't real. It was just her crazy brain making truth out of the detective's fiction, her mind trusting them more than it trusted itself. No, she hadn't tried to kill William in any normal way, but she had wished for his death, surrendered her desire to old John Bayou, and in that she was guilty. Who knew what she'd caused by bringing that bad juju on them? She could barely look at the items on the desk in case they sang of her guilt.
"Say nothing,"
her attorney had repeated when he'd arrived early again this morning. He needn't have worried. She'd never felt less like talking. She stared at the two items on the desk that the detectives had just referenced for the tape and swallowed hard. The two dolls, one male and one female, were coarsely hewn and small, but the female one was weighty all the same. Detective Anderson might not feel that, but Keisha did. The dolls were made from her clothes and William's, she knew that. But the weight in hers was what disturbed her. What was inside it? The other detective, Washington, kept looking too. Perhaps he had some grit in his soul, a history of night and earth. Maybe some relative somewhere in the city still practicing the old ways. Maybe she had tried to kill William, she thought, staring at the ugly charms. But if she had, then she'd been hexed into it. And if she hadn't, then she'd been hexed into taking the blame.
"You say you found one of these dolls in your drawer in the morning of July 8th. Is that correct?"
Keisha looked at her attorney, who nodded. "Yes," she said quietly. "When Elizabeth woke me up and said Billy had had a stroke or something, I rushed to get dressed and found it on top of my underwear."
"Did you react?"
"I didn't want to touch it. I wanted—" She bit her lip. She couldn't finish what she'd been about to say. "I wanted Marcy to come and make it better. I still want Marcy to come and make it better." She couldn't mention Marcy. She'd promised her. That memory wasn't jumbled.
"Because you recognized it as a voodoo doll?"
"Something like that."
"The second doll, the male doll, we found with the victim, on the desk in your husband's study, where he collapsed. Did you see that one?"
Keisha shook her head. "No, I was too worried about Billy."
"Did you tell anyone about the doll you found?"
"I'm not sure. I think so. Iris, maybe. It freaked me out. It wasn't the first thing like that."
Yes. There was a ball of some kind in the house. Is that right? Made of mud? You found it on the stairs and caused a bit of a scene."
"Billy said it was made of mud, but it was a conjure ball. The made of blood and grave dirt." She flinched slightly, remembering it. The thud on the steps.
"We've been speaking to the police in London about your family," Detective Anderson said.
"Are they coming here? My aunt and uncle?" Keisha asked. She couldn't deal with that on top of all this, their disappointment.
"They can't get visas," Washington answered. "They both have criminal records."
"And they were neither very forthcoming about your family relationship, nor very concerned about your predicament. The English police, however," Anderson continued, "have been very helpful."
She paused and leaned back in her chair.
"You had a difficult start in life, didn't you? Your mother killed herself when you were 5, is that right?"
"Yes." She could barely remember her mother, a ghost, always ghosts.
"She had a history of mental health issues and alcoholism, and after her death you went to live with your uncle and aunt."
"Yes," she said again.
"Your uncle is a scam artist, isn't he? Advertises his services as a witch doctor and promises to solve people's problems for cash. A lot of cash. Some of which clients are coerced into paying against their will for fear of repercussions."
"I don't know what my uncle does."
"Oh, come on."
Anderson smiled. Her front teeth were crooked, but the expression suddenly made her pretty.
"He wrote text for his website."
"I know he provides a service. I don't know about any scams.
My colleagues in London tell me their house, your old home, has lots of these kinds of items in it. Voodoo or some equivalent. Books, charms.
It must have been very unusual growing up there. It was normal to me.
So you saw these items on a regular basis?
My aunt is a believer.
Is it possible that after realizing it would be difficult to cause your husband's death by overdosing him with Viagra, you considered trying to scare him to death? This is the South, after all. We may not be New Orleans, but there's still a lot of superstition in our souls. You had all the tricks of the trade you'd learned back in England. Were you hoping to induce a heart attack, perhaps? And Mr. Radford was an older, overweight man trying to keep up with a young new wife. A heart attack wouldn't be suspicious.
I was the one who was afraid, not Billy.
So you said.
Detective Anderson leaned back in her chair and tapped a pen against the desk. And all Keisha could hear in her head was the thud of the conjure ball on the stairs again.
Were you in it with your family? Anderson asked. Did they send you here with the dolls and tell you what to do? Judging from their emails, they were certainly keen for Mr. Radford's money to start coming their way.
No, Keisha said. No, no, no. Auntie Aya would never share her gifts with me. Never. It was Washington who leaned forward this time, his thick, gym-heavy arms resting on the desk, his eyes narrowing. He could sense what Anderson couldn't. Keisha's belief.
And why is that?
He asked. Keisha looked him straight in the eye. She says I'm cursed, that I'm mad, because of the boy, the ghost boy. She swallowed hard. The boy who wasn't there.
What boy?
The two detectives asked in unison. 46. She wasn't sure quite what the sex was supposed to have cured, but judging by the way Jason kept flashing her his best lopsided, sexy grin as they drove to the hospital, telling her that they were a team, the indestructible Maddoxes, and that within a week there'd be nothing to worry about. Somehow, by letting him screw her, she'd agreed that their secrets would cancel each other out. He was acting as if she'd caught him covering up a red wine spill on a favorite expensive couch, rather than risking both their lives by stealing money. Let's hope so, she said curtly, as he pulled into the parking lot. And for a second, his new good humor slipped.
Jesus, Marcy, can you at least try to be positive?
Oh, I'm sorry, honey. Her blood fired hot. For a minute there, I thought I'd just found out that this entire year has been a web of lies on your part, and that we're lucky your partner has been poisoned, otherwise you'd be in prison, and I would at the very least be left homeless. She stepped out of the car and closed the door, watching him as he did the same on the other side, and noticing the two young nurses who passed, both giving him an appreciative glance. She didn't blame them. He was still butter wouldn't melt, charming, handsome Jason Maddox, still full of confidence, still full of shit. So forgive me if it's going to take a day or so to process this.
Now you know how I feel, he muttered. You lied first, Marcy, and you lied for longer.
By the time they reached the exclusive private rooms on the top floor, free of the visiting rules and regulations of the lower levels, they were holding hands. For all intents and purposes, the perfect, concerned couple, worried about one of their closest friends. As Marcy signed their names in the register, Jason spoke in hushed tones to the nurse, who then led them down a silent corridor, decorated with bright modern art and vases of crisp, fresh flowers that made Marcy believe even more that William wasn't going to make it. The whole place stank of somewhere that the rich came to politely die. They didn't need the nurse to point out which of the vast rooms was William's. There was only one door with a plainclothes officer sipping a cup of coffee outside. She'd half expected to see the rest of their set already in the room, but there was only Elizabeth, looking tired and older than usual, wrapped in a cardigan, a far cry from her usual staidly smart self, sitting in a reclining armchair by the bed. It was hard to recognize William, his formidable form suddenly diminished, now simply a fleshy, pale hub for the wires that snaked out of him to various machines humming in the background. Looking at him made her think of the yearbook sent to Jason, and she felt haunted all over again, once more a pawn in a game she didn't understand.
"Have you been here all night?"
Marcy asked as Elizabeth stood to greet them.
"Most of it."
Her eyes were bloodshot.
"I couldn't sleep at home, so I came back in. The doctor said he still has his hearing, so I thought I'd talk to him for a while in case he's afraid in there. I did some reading when I ran out of things to say."
She nodded over at the bedside table, where a battered paperback lay.
"Moby Dick. I've always wanted to read it, so I figured I'd do so out loud."
"Is he going to get better?"
Jason asked. He sounded hopeful, and Marcy wondered what answer he was hoping for. Life would certainly be easier for Jason if William at least took his time getting back on his feet. Elizabeth shrugged, her eyes filling up, and signaled them to a corner, glancing over her shoulder as if William would be straining to eavesdrop. Marcy figured William was too busy straining to stay alive.
"It's so awful. Who would have thought coolant could do such terrible, agonizing things to a human body? His kidneys are failing, his liver is very damaged, and the specialists are running tests to see how much. He's lost his sight and is in a coma. There may even be brain damage. An ounce more in that drink and he'd have been dead or a deaf, blind vegetable for sure. But still, the next 24 hours are crucial."
Her face trembled as she fought back more tears.
"But even if he lives, he will never be himself again, not fully recovered."
"Did the doctors say that?"
Jason asked.
"Not in so many words, not yet. But they did say that if he made it through the next few hours, then they'll have to evaluate the extent of the long-term damage. He may need constant care, even if he can be discharged."
"That's so awful," Marcy muttered. Why had she come here? These were details she didn't need.
"I can't help but think he'd rather be dead. That decision is in the Lord's hands. If he lives, even if he lives like this, the Lord must have a purpose for him."
"I guess so," Marcy said. "Do you want me to go get you some coffee or breakfast?" Anything to get out of the room. The sight of William, so ruined, was making her skin crawl.
"I'm fine," Elizabeth said. "Really, the nurses have gotten me so much coffee this morning, I'll probably never sleep again. I'm still in shock, I guess, like everyone else. I can't believe that something like this could have happened."
"The police are preparing to charge Keisha," Jason said. "That's what Noah told us last night."
"I heard. That's shocking, too. I don't understand why she'd have done something so obvious. Maybe she panicked when he said he was ending it. The post-nup stopped her getting his money in a divorce, but she stood to inherit plenty if he died. And I mean, a lot."
"But from what the police say, she nearly got away with it,"
Jason said. Marcy didn't like the gossipy tone in either of their voices as they talked, so she left them chatting and went to the restroom, where she could breathe freely without thinking she was sucking in William's poisoned air. She took far longer than she needed washing and drying her hands, scrubbing herself clean until her skin was pink and raw. And when she finally returned, Jason was thankfully making their excuses to leave.
"I'm heading home myself in 30 minutes or so, after I've seen the doctors again," Elizabeth said. "I'll get some rest and take a shower. I have to check how things are at the house, too. The police, I expect they're still looking for the syringe she used. I dread to think what kind of mess they're making. Zelda will be going quietly crazy. You know she likes to keep that place spotless."
"We'll come see William again soon," Marcy said, leaning in to give the dumpy woman a polite half-hug, hoping that Jason didn't drag her back too quickly. This room, with William in it, felt as if it had absorbed all the rot of her past and Jason's present. It was hellish and too warm and cloying. It was trying to suffocate her. She'd be happy to never come back ever again. She would, of course. Appearances had to be maintained. It was only when she went to sign them out on the visitor's register that Marcy idly scanned down the other names as she waited for Jason to come back from the men's room. She saw it halfway down. A visitor for William Radford at 3 a.m. Jacqueline Marshall. Jackie. 47. It was amazing how such a big house could still feel claustrophobic with only two people in it, if the atmosphere was right, or, perhaps more accurately, wrong. Marcy had tried to sleep while Jason retreated to his study to carry on doing whatever it took to right the mess he'd put them in. As the day ticked around to evening, she'd offered to go pick up some Chinese takeout. Anything for some fresh air, to be out, away from him and his, "I'll make it up to you, it will be a fresh start for both of us" bullshit. She drove slowly around the city, not heading straight to the restaurant, instead giving herself some time alone with her thoughts. She wished she could speak to Keisha to find out exactly what had happened. In so many ways, Marcy hoped it was all true, that Keisha had tried to kill William. It would make everything a whole lot smoother. If William died and Keisha was guilty, then Jason would automatically be senior partner and take over running the firm, probably without the hassle of a buyout. And then there would be a new king and queen in town, a new Magnolia. It would also be easier to try to get back on an even keel with Jason if Keisha wasn't around. If Marcy didn't have to see her, then maybe the spell Keisha seemed to have her under would finally break. She thought about her too much, the feel of her, the touch. Even in the midst of all this madness, there was an animal hunger at her core that Jason's touch couldn't satisfy, especially now that Keisha was so definitely out of reach. Jason. What was she going to do about him? She burned with resentment and anger at his lies and deceit. But she needed to be nicer to him, at least until they were past this immediate crisis. And after that, would she divorce him? Would he divorce her? Was he simply being nice to her because she knew? Or maybe he was right. Maybe now that they'd stripped down to their bare secrets in front of each other, things would be better. She wasn't sure it worked that way somehow. That's why secrets normally stayed secret. Secrets broke things. For now, though, she'd play the game. Whatever the hell the game was. Games. Once again, her thoughts turned to Jackie. Jason hadn't been concerned when Marcy told him that his ex-wife had gone to the hospital in the middle of the night. He said she was an insomniac and always up and at the gym while the world was sleeping. It used to drive him crazy. Plus, she'd known William for a long time before she moved. It was hardly a surprise that she'd go visit him. Marcy had told him that Jackie had been at the party too, casually trying to find out if Jason had spoken to her. Apparently not. He claimed not to have seen her. He had shrugged and said that now Jackie was back, however much they tried to avoid her, it was likely she'd end up moving in the same circles as them. He'd then closed the conversation down by saying they had bigger problems right now than being jealous of Jackie. Jealous of Jackie. She'd wanted to punch him for that. What if Jackie was their problem? There was still an odd edge to Jason when he spoke of her. Was that simply the awkwardness of discussing an ex-wife with a current one? Or something else? Jason had proven himself a slippery eel when it came to the truth. Was he keeping more from her? What had Jackie been talking to him about that afternoon at Saatchi's? Jason had called her. Marcy couldn't forget that. Jason, who was so bad at confrontation, had called his bitter ex-wife by choice. Had she been trying to get him back and he'd turned her down? Could she have done some digging and sent the yearbook to try to split them up? It was possible. Or maybe she wanted more than that. Maybe she'd done it for money. True, she probably didn't need it, but taking it from Jason would still give her pleasure. She'd tried to take everything when they divorced. Maybe this was her trying to clean up again. Whoever it was who'd sent it probably wanted money. Otherwise, they'd have told other people what they discovered, and Marcy would be in the crap right now. The thought was a relief. Everything was nearly always about money. What was it Mama used to say? Her pearls of wisdom on the world. Money, sex, and power are the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost of life, honey. Just remember that. And women can get all three if they're not stupid, so don't be stupid. The city looked different at dusk, the night coming to life as the day died, shadows like ghosts under each street lamp. and she finally headed to pick up their food and take it home. Jason was in the kitchen, plates and cutlery ready, two glasses of wine poured.
Where have you been? You've been gone for nearly 2 hours.
I'm sorry, she said, leaning in and kissing him. There was a line, and you know how I hate to wait, so I went for a drive. Got carried away.
I thought you weren't coming back.
He sounded so lost and lonely, her heart almost melted a little. Almost. I'm not going anywhere. She smiled through gritted teeth. I just needed some space. She nodded toward the cartons. Kung Pao shrimp, and a couple of your other favorites.
You sure you're okay?
Sure, she said. I love you. Hollow words. She found herself thinking of Keisha when she said them. Wild, free, and open Keisha. So different from this liar of a husband of hers. Her heart would recover, though. It always did. They ate as if everything were normal, and then, before they went to bed, Marcy called the hospital to see if there had been any change. There hadn't. They hadn't heard from Virginia or Iris all day, and Marcy hadn't called them either. They were all withdrawing to process what had happened to William, and she wished she could do the same without the rest of this shit strangling them. This evening, she and Jason both undressed in the same room, Marcy dropping her clothes on top of the party dress and mask abandoned on the floor, what felt like a lifetime ago. They had sex, bodies going through the motions, enforced intimacy between sudden strangers. Finally, they fell apart, both panting. Neither of them spoke, and within minutes, Jason fell into a deep sleep, leaving Marcy wide awake and staring at the ceiling, wishing the man next to her and his lies were still in the guest bedroom. At around 5, the thunder started, low rumblings overhead that grew into a storm, lashing the house with wind and rain, and keeping the morning dark. By 7, they knew that William hadn't died in the night. He was breathing by himself, and whatever life he'd been left with was refusing to give up. He was here for the long haul, living in the dark, hooked up to machines. He could afford to be. Marcy wondered if poverty would have been better for William now. At least he'd have been able to let go, to die with dignity. Instead, he'd be left to rot away in a hospital bed, like some awful zombie for the next however many years they could keep him breathing. She made coffee, the rain keeping them housebound for now, as Jason took calls from clients and other attorneys in the firm. And for a while, Marcy stood outside the study door, watching him through the narrow gap. She felt something between awe and dread, the emotion he was managing to instill in his voice, without any showing in his face or manner. Who was this chameleon she'd married? He'd be at work by lunchtime, she heard him say, which was a relief. She'd have the afternoon to herself. Maybe she'd sleep. God. She needed to sleep. 48. Keisha had found the storm comforting before the lights went on and the new day started. It was as if all the madness in her head had fled this cell and taken to the skies. She felt empty. There had been so much talking yesterday, so many questions that her head had been left whirling. Some she'd answered and some she hadn't, depending on what her lawyer had told her to do. She'd been a good puppet as he pulled her strings, and it was easier than thinking for herself. Thunder rolled again. How loud must it have been outside if she could hear it all the way down here in the bowels of the building? It was the grumble of ghosts. Ghosts. Her head had been filled with ghosts. The boy, always the boy. Eleanor, Lyle, and William. Except William wasn't dead. He was somewhere in between. Did the ghosts talk to him now, too? Today's nugget of treasure, a glittering jewel of a gift, had been the news that William wasn't going to die yet, which meant that neither would she if they found her guilty. It would be attempted murder, not murder. A life in a cell for her, and a life trapped unmoving in the dark for him. Buried alive in his own skin. She trembled. Guilty. Was she guilty? She hadn't wished this on him. She'd expected more questions today, or for this to reach what seemed the natural conclusion. They'd charge her. Even her lawyer, her attorney as they called him, was talking about plea deals and mitigating circumstances, as if her fate was predestined to go a certain way. She should be more nervous, but it all rolled over her. She'd reached too high above her station, and now she had to fall. The girls at the club would be laughing now. What would Dolly think? Had the police already talked to her? She stared at the ceiling of her cell, drifting through memories. Maybe this would be it for the rest of her life. A narrow bed, a narrow room, a narrow view. Bells and shouting and routine. No more drinking and dancing. No more aiming high. She felt suddenly desperately tired. At least she'd escaped her family. But no more Marcy. How was she supposed to cope with that? When her attorney returned, his fat face was smiling. It wasn't an expression she'd seen before.
"I've got some good news," he said. "The game is not lost."
He rubbed his hands together. A game. Her life was a game to him.
"They're not charging you yet, but they have applied to keep you 96 hours without charge, and that's been granted."
"That's the good news?" she asked. It didn't sound so good. The conclusion was probably still inevitable.
"No, that's not it."
He drew himself up tall and his grin widened.
"There's a fresh line of inquiry, a serious one. A new suspect. They're bringing him in now."
Keisha's head swirled as she gasped, her heart thumping, life bursting through her veins again. She'd resigned herself to this fate. She'd half convinced herself that she'd actually done it. Now here was a glimmer of hope, a chance at freedom. It was almost too much to bear. "Him," the attorney had said. "But who?" 49. Marcy knew that surreal thoughts had a tendency to fill her head when she was panicking, but that didn't stop her from being annoyed that the cleaner wasn't due until tomorrow, and they were traipsing all over her house while the bathrooms weren't perfect and there were clothes on the bedroom floor. "Do you have a personal computer in the house, Mrs. Maddox?" Detective Anderson asked. "We'll need to take it if you do."
"An iPad," Marcy said. "I think it's in the kitchen. And a MacBook in the den, where the rest of the boxes we haven't unpacked are, but I never use that."
They'd already taken Jason's desktop and laptop. She'd seen them go by as the officers took them out. Her nerves jangled. He said he'd thrown the yearbook in the trash. She hadn't checked. What if he hadn't? Where was it?
"Are you sure I can't get you some tea?" she asked again.
She knew she was pale and trembling. At least her fear was helping her fake her shock. She'd gotten out of the shower, a long, blissfully hot affair, barely 90 minutes before, to find Jason throwing clothes in a duffel bag and rummaging in a drawer for his passport. Sandy had sent him a text from the restroom telling him that the police were all over the office, locking it down. He'd snapped at Marcy to get packing. They needed to go, immediately. Marcy hadn't moved. Wrapped in a towel, skin scrubbed pink, and brain fuzzy from the heat. She'd instead sat on the bed and told him no, they couldn't run. How guilty would they look? She'd asked how obvious his issues, she hadn't wanted to say thefts, were in the accounts or whatever at work. He'd said they'd have to dig deep to find the start of the trail, but he didn't even understand why they were looking. There was no reason to. No one was suspicious of him at work. He was the golden boy, the king in waiting. Why would they be storming the firm as if they knew something? There hadn't been any more time for discussion because the doorbell had rung and Marcy had quickly emptied out the bag and crammed it in the closet while Jason answered the door. And now here they were. Or rather, here they weren't. Only Marcy was, in her robe with her hair still wet. Her husband had been taken in for questioning, while she worried that the men searching her house were judging her cleaning standards.
"I'm fine, thank you,"
Anderson said, answering for both herself and the huge detective standing behind the couch where she sat. I know this must be unsettling, but we will leave your house tidy, I assure you. Marcy nodded. She'd already been through the I don't understand why you're here routine, and she didn't want to lay her disbelief on too thick. They'd had a tip-off, Anderson had said, before they took Jason away, regarding his financial activities in the firm. Jason had already called Thomas Tanier to come down and meet him. At least they didn't have to worry about representation. Attorneys always knew the best attorneys. Marcy, however, didn't have one, and she wasn't refusing to cooperate. She was a good, law-abiding Southern wife, doing her best to smooth out this terrible mistake. Oh, please, God, don't let them find the yearbook. On the night of the 7th of July, at William Radford's party, your husband and Mr. Radford had an argument in his office in the house. What do you know about that? Nothing, really. And argument is a strong word. William and Jason were close friends. They didn't ever argue. But it was a strong disagreement then. As I said, I don't know. I wasn't there. I felt unwell and went home early. Yes, Elizabeth Glapien told my colleague that she drove you home. But she'd said she'd found you outside the office, and you both heard raised voices. She said that you were nervous about interrupting. So they'd been to Elizabeth before they'd come here. Maybe before they'd gone to the firm, getting their ducks in a row. I was, yes. But then I never like to interrupt Jason when he's talking to anyone about work. It's not my business. But there were raised voices. A little, yes. She was picking her way through a minefield. She kept her hands down, resting on her knees, so Anderson couldn't see the sheen of sweat on her palms. I think it was something to do with the system crash at the office. That was all I heard. So it was nothing to do with the audit that was planned? Your husband wasn't worried about that? No. Why would he be? Jason was keen for the buyout to go ahead. Her heart raced. Jason had said the police would have to dig to find a trail. She had a feeling this woman intended to. Are you aware of any financial problems your husband might have? We don't have any, as far as I know. Anderson looked around the large room. This is a beautiful house. Thank you. You only just moved here? That's right. Expensive, though, and a big step up from your last home. To be fair, that wasn't exactly small either. Marcy smiled, but not too confidently. It must be hard to keep up when you're close friends with someone like William Radford. A big house, exclusive country club fees, designer furniture. She paused. A failed business? It must all add up. Do you mean my boutique? Marcy's back stiffened. That risk had been factored in before we started. Her face flushed again, her tell of anger. She hoped the detective misread it as embarrassment. So you never argued over money? No, she answered, ignoring the memories of the fights in this very room over her expensive choices. Never. I guess it was difficult for Jason, though. An older man with a much younger, beautiful wife to impress. Marcy laughed. I was a waitress when we met. He didn't have to do much to impress me. He fell in love with me. That was enough. Anderson nodded, as if satisfied, before becoming thoughtful. She wasn't fooling Marcy, pretending that her questions were coming to her on the spot. This was a planned attack. Anderson was nobody's fool. When did your husband get home after the party? I don't know. He didn't wake me. She didn't say that he'd slept in a guest bedroom. Hopefully they wouldn't notice that the sheets were used. Jason bought and refilled the coolant in Keisha Radford's Corvette. Is that correct? You saw him? Marcy's eyes widened. Well, yes, but— And the coolant cap was loose, he said, and that had caused the leak. Is it possible, do you think, that someone could have loosened that cap on purpose? To make sure Mrs. Radford was seen learning about such a toxic substance,
and that it would be found in her house after the attack on her husband.
I don't know what you're... I don't understand.
Marcy's face was no longer flushing. It was burning. The grass you smoked with Keisha Radford that she'd found in Eleanor Radford's drawer.
I already spoke about this with the officer who talked to me after William was found. I don't make a habit of it, and
I can totally understand how you and Mrs. Radford ended up getting high. Anderson smiled again, all faux friendship and sisterly confidence. Two young women together, a new friendship. That's not what I was going to ask you about. No.
She leaned forward, resting her elbows on her spread knees, a masculine pose designed to intimidate.
What I wondered was if your husband knew about the other drugs Keisha found in that drawer, the morphine needles and syringes. Did he know about those?
No, she answered, her mouth drying even as she answered truthfully. No, he didn't.
She let her hands clasp together, tight and afraid. She didn't have to fake that.
Look, this is all some kind of mistake. Jason and William are best friends. Jason would never hurt William. He wouldn't. He couldn't.
She was cut off as Anderson's cell rang, and the detective was on her feet, her back to Marcy. What now? The call took less than a minute, and when it finished, Marcy knew they were in trouble. There was a shift in the air. Her stomach turned to ice.
We're going to need a full search, she said to her sidekick before turning back to Marcy. Mrs. Maddox, do you have a friend you can stay with tonight?
A friend? Keisha was her friend, but Keisha was locked up.
I think so. Her voice was quiet. Why can't I stay here? What are you looking for? When is Jason coming home?
You'd better go and pack what you need. Detective Washington, go with Mrs. Maddox, please.
They didn't even trust her to get some clothes without watching her. This was bad. What had they found at the office? What were they going to find here? She knew what they were looking for, the syringe. But they wouldn't find it. Jason hadn't known about the needles. Jason didn't hurt William. Still, as she threw her wash bag, a nightie, and some fresh clothes in the duffel she'd only just emptied from Jason's attempt at fleeing, she felt dizzy with fear. It was only later, when she was in the cab, that she remembered. They'd been in the car on the way home after the first time she'd hung out with Keisha, after the first kiss. He'd been angry with her for getting high, and she'd laughed and said it wasn't hers. She'd told him where Keisha had found the grass. She'd told him what else had been in Eleanor's drawer. Jason very definitely had known about the needles. 50. Marcy had burst into tears as soon as Iris opened the door. Real, hot tears of shame and fear that made her sob loudly, surprised at her own loss of control. And she felt a rush of gratitude when the older woman wrapped an arm around her shoulder and ushered her inside to the safety of the polished wooden floor and elegant class of the old colonial mansion. Iris had sent the housekeeper to her rooms for the evening to give them privacy, and then soothed Marcy, made her chicken soup, and reassured her that it was all no doubt a terrible mistake. Noah was out. Iris didn't say as much, but he was obviously trying to manage the shit fest of William's attempted murder. The media was loving every sordid detail of it, and Marcy knew that Jason would be all over the news by morning.
I don't think it can be a mistake, she said quietly, wiping her eyes with her sweatshirt sleeve. I don't mean that I think Jason hurt William. God, I don't believe that. I can't. But the money...
Tears threatened to spill again. Whatever happened now, she was pretty sure her life was in ruins. The police had found something. She was going to be broke again, back in the gutter. Jason probably going to be in prison for a long time. She didn't have to fake how upset she was, and she knew it would be worse when the reality sank in. She'd be alone again. But Iris, she thought as she sipped the homemade broth,
was turning out to be a kinder person than Marcy had ever given her credit for. She wasn't the snob she'd always thought. She'd had sympathy for Keisha, even when unsure whether she might have poisoned William. Would she also be sympathetic to Marcy's plight? Maybe they'd all rally around her, make sure she wasn't left destitute.
I mean, surely they'd have let him go by now if there was nothing.
Iris leaned across the kitchen table and squeezed her hand.
There is no point in worrying until you know if there is something to worry about, which I know is easier said than done.
But why would he steal from the firm? It's so not Jason. Do you think maybe he has a gambling problem?
Iris sipped her tea.
The things men do never fail to surprise me. Surprise and disappoint in equal measure. Even Noah still has his moments, old as he is. They all like to keep up, don't they? But the problem with a race is that someone is always ahead, and the rest are always chasing. The keeping up is endless and exhausting. The benefit of being as old as I am, my dear, is that you learn to stop giving a shit.
Marcy giggled to her tears as Iris smiled.
That's better. Nothing like an old woman swearing to make youth laugh. Now dry your eyes and finish your soup. You don't need to get any thinner, not while I'm looking after you.
The doorbell rang and Marcy stiffened, her heart racing as Iris went to answer it. What now? Virginia, of course it was. And Marcy heard her before she saw her, as was often the way.
What a day, Iris. Emmett's still talking to the police about Jason's investments. Now there's a situation that's floored me, I don't mind saying.
She stopped in the doorway mid-sentence.
Oh, you didn't say Marcy was here. To be fair, dear, you haven't given me a chance. Marcy's staying the night.
Iris didn't add, because the police are searching her house, and neither did she look overly happy that Virginia had shown up unannounced.
If you'd rather, I can go, Virginia said. I only stopped by for 30 minutes or so. Don't be silly, Iris said. Let's have a glass of wine. I think we all probably need it.
What investments?
Marcy asked lightly. The email to Emmett, telling him to pick up his phone. Just how much of his ill-gotten gains had Jason gambled on the markets with?
You didn't know.
Virginia waved Iris on to fill the large glass to the top.
Although neither did I. Not my business and all, and Emmett doesn't like to talk about friends' money.
She took a long sip.
What investments?
Marcy repeated, wanting to take the glass and smash it into Virginia's too smooth, expensively plump face.
I don't know exactly, I'm afraid. Some big sums, apparently. High risk, high yield. Some more secure, but with longer investment periods. That's all I've gleaned. But now I know why Emmett was getting all those early morning calls when we were in the islands. Jason wanted his returns or his money back. He was getting very heated, apparently. Emmett couldn't get the money out as fast as Jason wanted it. I don't know how all this works, if I'm honest. But Emmett didn't know that it wasn't.
Virginia checked herself.
Might not have been all Jason's money. He figured Jason was playing the markets to raise the money to buy William out and pay the house off or whatever.
She at least had the decency to look slightly flustered and embarrassed as she spoke. But Marcy barely noticed. Her head was spinning. All those late night and pre-dawn calls, were they all to Emmett? Why had Jason started panicking? William came back from Europe early. Of course. Marcy's throat constricted as if a noose were around it. A social noose for her, and potentially a literal one for Jason. Could he have tried to kill William because the audit was going to show what he'd been doing, and there was no longer enough time to put it right? He knew about the syringes, although there was no way she'd be telling the police that. He knew where the coolant was, and he knew Keisha was a bit crazy, and maybe even knew that William was having second thoughts. If William had told Noah, he could easily have mentioned it to Jason, too. She swallowed some wine, her fingers trembling on the glass. What was the prison time for fraud or embezzlement or whatever he'd done? It was enough for Jason's father to have killed himself rather than face it. Was it worth killing William to save himself from prison and to keep his position in this world? No, not keep. Improve it.
We don't know anything yet, Iris said. And Marcy's worried enough.
She flashed Virginia a look. After everything that happened with Jason's father, and how hard Jason fought to get back on track after it, I can't believe that it won't all turn out to be a mistake until someone presents me with hard evidence. And you should do the same too, Virginia.
I was only saying, Virginia replied archly.
Well, don't, dear. And that was that. Iris moved the conversation to tennis and the latest tornado to hit Florida, and how lucky they'd been to escape it. But maybe there was something they could do to raise money for those who'd lost their homes. Virginia didn't stay long, thankfully, a call from Emmett summoning her home like a good wife. But at least while she'd been there, Marcy had been able to zone out and sit lost in her own dire thoughts. Would they let her see Jason tomorrow? Maybe they'd let him go. That didn't seem likely. Investing large sums with Emmett, the office being ripped apart, their house being searched. They wouldn't do that to Jason if they didn't have some sort of evidence already. He was too well connected to want to get him pissed if they weren't pretty sure something was awry. Everyone involved in this was too well connected, except Keisha. Had she been thrown to the wolves as a distraction? Underlying everything, all of it, was her terrible fear for herself. Jason had said he'd thrown the yearbook away, but was it still sitting in the trash? What about her hidden box? What had he done with that? Would the police find it? Was the person who'd sent the yearbook to Jason the same one who'd tipped off the police about his fraud? And if so, why? Why tried to destroy them, and why now?
I think an early night is what you need, dear, Iris said. I'll settle you into Eleanor's room and then bring you up a hot chocolate.
Eleanor's room?
I need to stop calling it that, but it's the room she used to sleep in when she stayed over.
Did she stay here a lot? Marcy's legs felt like lead as she followed Iris up the grand old staircase, her bag over her shoulder. She was dog-tired, even though she was convinced she wouldn't sleep.
Sometimes, when William would be away for work when we were a lot younger. When the kids were small, they'd all play together. Lyle was smaller, but such a sweet boy. And then, of course, after...
Iris opened a door down the corridor leading to the master bedroom.
She needed somewhere she could grieve properly, so we gave her this room to have as her own. It's not the largest guest room, but the coziest, I think. This house is too big. If it hadn't been in Noah's family for generations, I'd have wanted to sell up and move somewhere smaller, somewhere homier. She sighed.
I don't see why everything has to be so big all the time. You must feel it in that monstrosity of a house Jason just moved you into.
Marcy let the unintentional insult slide. Monstrosity. The house had been her choice. She'd demanded it. She thought it was as good as this one.
Maybe Iris thought this was a monstrosity too, an albatross of history around her neck. Marcy didn't comment, though, because she was too distracted by the wall of her room for the night, a room that by nobody's standards was anything other than large, at the center of which was an oversized double bed with a huge patchwork comforter on it. A thick rug lay on either side of the bed, and away from the dresser and wardrobe, against the far wall, were four bookshelves of different heights that created a quirky skyline of colored spines. Iris was right. There was something comforting about it. The wall, though, the one that her eyes were drawn back to, that was something else. So many framed photographs, so many of Eleanor and Lyle, a lifetime in images.
Wow, she said softly.
William made it hard for her to grieve sometimes. He wanted to put it all away, out of sight, out of mind. He couldn't cope, he said. She sighed, leaning casually against the doorframe, and in the soft yellow lighting from the bedroom lamp and the hall chandelier, there was the echo of the woman she'd been in her 30s and 40s. It was hard for Marcy to imagine. But then Marcy had never imagined Eleanor as youthful and free as she appeared in some of these pictures. It took a moment before she realized that Iris was in a few too, laughing on the beach with Lyle holding her hand on one side and Eleanor's on the other, the two women having a great time. Best friends. How nice to have a friend like that, Marcy thought with a pang of envy. Men always think their feelings run deeper than ours when the situation is about them, Iris continued. But it's not true. They just make more noise about theirs, and they have deep feelings so rarely compared to women that the emotions come as something of a surprise to them. She paused and then straightened up. Anyway, there's a shower or bath and fresh towels in the bathroom and a robe in the closet if you need it. There's also a TV tucked away in the cabinet by the window if you can't sleep, or a book, of course. But you get settled. I'll be back up with the chocolate, and if you're in the bathroom, I'll just leave it by the bed. And try not to make yourself too upset. We'll know more in the morning, I'm sure. Life is always better when you know exactly what it is you have to deal with. As she turned to go, Marcy, on impulse, called her back. I know I've not always been too friendly, she said awkwardly. And thank you for being very kind to me. I know a lot of people wouldn't, given everything that's going on right now. Oh, you'd be surprised, Iris said. We can be funny in this town, I'll give you that. Little things matter. Surface things can become overly important. But when it comes down to it, when the big storms come, all that disappears. We take pride in our Christian values, the real ones. Not judging others too harshly, looking for the best in people. Fairness, kindness. I suppose that's why I ended up married to a judge. She smiled. Plus, of course, we're all steeped in history here. Everyone has shame at some point in their family's past. You learn to be sympathetic and not judge one person for the sins of another. I found it hard being the second wife, Marcy said. After the divorce and everything, I always felt that everyone thought I wasn't good enough to be part of all this. I was too coarse, too common, hard, too trailer trash, I guess. The final words were out before she could stop them. No one knew about the trailer park, not until Jason on Saturday night. But it was only a turn of phrase, and Iris didn't show any curiosity. It's hard to come into something so established. That is true, Iris said. But everyone worries. I remember Jackie worrying about her Creole roots being judged. But you know what I've found in life? Marcy looked up at her from her seat on the side of the bed. Often what you worry other people might be thinking of you is most likely to be what you think of yourself. Be kinder to yourself, Marcy. Nobody's perfect. Marcy's exhaustion took hold fast, and after barely a sip of her chocolate, and with the bedside lamp still on, she closed her eyes for a second and was gone. She slept deep and long and dreamless, as if the dead mother and son trapped smiling on the wall had gifted her a taste of their eternal rest. And if Iris hadn't shaken her awake, she'd probably have stayed lost in the darkness all day. What? She muttered as she was dragged unwillingly back to consciousness. The lamplight had been eclipsed by streaks of early morning sunshine from beyond the shutters and drawn drapes. She squinted and looked up at Iris looming over her, resisting the urge to close her eyes again. You'd better get up. It was the tone of Iris's voice that made Marcy suddenly alert. Gone was the tender warmth of last night. It had been replaced by something cool and suspicious. Her heart raced. What is it? The police are here. Iris paused. Her mouth was tight and her spine stiff. This was not good at all. Marcy pushed herself upright. You okay, Iris? They say you have to get dressed. They have a warrant for your arrest. And with that, Marcy knew her house of cards had crumbled. Be kinder to yourself, Marcy. Nobody's perfect. No one would be saying anything like that to her again for a long time. 51.
You know something? Kate Anderson looked almost entertained on the other side of the interview table from Marcy.
I don't think I've ever worked a case where my problem was having too many suspects who could all easily be guilty. The issue I have is, and don't take this personally, that you're all such truly atrocious people.
The second detective, a muscle-bound hulk of a man whose skin was so dark it shone, smiled as Anderson paused and sipped her coffee. Marcy was letting her own grow cold. She knew how it would taste from a styrofoam cup, plasticky, too cheap, and too strong. She'd been in a room like this before, with an equally useless court-appointed lawyer beside her, just like now. The coffee was meant to amp up whatever jitters the suspect had.
The first, Anderson continued, there's the beautiful, very young, and slightly unbalanced new foreign wife who saw the opportunity to stick her claws into a wealthy widower far away from home. A hasty, unhappy marriage that William Radford was already regretting and planning to be free of with no financial loss.
She sighed, enjoying the theater of her statement. Marcy had thought the detective was dour, but there was definite humor glinting in her eyes now. It made her look younger and happier. None of it stopped Marcy from wanting to smash her in the face.
Isn't that so often the way? Anderson continued. Pick something up on your vacation that looks great in its natural location, and then when you get it to your house, you realize it doesn't really fit with the rest of your stuff, and you end up throwing it away.
Marcy said nothing, but she got the feeling that Detective Anderson didn't much like what she knew of William any more than the people she was investigating for trying to kill him.
Then, of course, we have your husband, Jason Maddox, Mr. Radford's colleague and close friend. We found enough discrepancies, for want of a better word, in the Radford and partner's accounts to be preparing to charge him with embezzlement. The way I see it is that William came back from Europe 6 months before he planned to, and Jason didn't have time to cover all his tracks. So both Keisha Radford and Jason Maddox had motive and opportunity to try to kill William Radford. And to be honest, I was veering very much toward Jason being the more likely candidate. He's too smooth for my taste. Until he asked to speak to me at 5 a.m. this morning.
She leaned across the table.
When he told me to go look in the air vent in your dressing room, where he'd hidden this.
She pushed the old yearbook across the table, the pages open to where Marcy's young, sullen face stared back.
And so here we are, Savannah Cassidy.
Her air vent. Of course that's where Jason had put it, right back where she'd hidden everything. She stared at the old photograph. Savannah Cassidy, a name that had become her destination, with everywhere on the map to choose from. She'd moved someplace where she'd at least never forget the name she was given at birth. She looked up at Anderson.
My name isn't Savannah Cassidy, it's Marcy Maddox. I changed it legally to Marcy Brown before I left Boise. I have the paperwork.
She wasn't waiting for the poor excuse of a publicly appointed attorney beside her to interject.
Or I guess I presume you do if you have my box of private things.
Any tears she may have been holding back burned dry as a flash of anger heated her. Anderson turned the pages of the yearbook before sliding it over again.
Johnny Newham, your high school sweetheart. So, as the mysterious note that was sent to your husband along with this asks, what happened to Johnny?
You know what happened to Johnny. Marcy sniped back. She wasn't going to go through all this again, not over Johnny. That was dead and buried, the past. Screw Anderson and her shovel.
Do we?
Anderson raised an eyebrow.
Why don't you tell us to make sure?
Johnny died. He killed himself. Her back straightened, even though she knew where this was leading. She was walking on quicksand that could drag her down at any moment. We got married straight out of high school. He got us a trailer in the mobile home park. I worked shifts in the diner, and he worked in a car shop a mile or so away. We were poor but happy, and thinking of starting a family. Then there was an accident, and Johnny's leg got crushed under a truck. He should have gotten compensation, but it turned out he'd been drinking on his lunch break, and it was likely his fault. He didn't fight it. She sighed. Things got bad after that. I worked more shifts, and Johnny drank all our extra money. He started on drugs. He was a different person.
But he'd straightened out before he died.
Yes, or so he said. Who knows, really? Her voice was soft. She hadn't spoken of this in so many years, and now here she was, telling her sorry tale for the second time in a week. But probably. He definitely seemed straighter for a month or so. He'd been doing some cash work on people's cars when he could. We were getting back on track, talking about a baby some more. A compensation company had even come along and said they could get him some money for his accident.
And they did, didn't they? You got that.
I did. After he died.
So I repeat the question. What happened to Johnny, Marcy?
I don't know. I went to work. I had an 8-hour shift that evening, finishing at 11. When I went, he was watching daytime TV, and there were leftovers in the fridge. He was having a bad day with his leg, and he was in a real mean mood. It didn't make me want to come home. I needed a beer, so I went to the late-night place out by the freeway to meet up with Janie Spence, one of the other waitresses. I wanted to be young, have a good time, drink, dance, all that stuff.
You danced with some men that night.
Yes, I did. Everyone knows that. It was in the files you've probably read, and it was all over the local TV and radio. I danced, I got drunk.